From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the author of The Virgin Suicides, Jeffrey Eugenides. His critically acclaimed 1993 novel about five teenage sisters who commit suicide is the basis of the current film directed by Sofia Coppola. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new novels about China, Becoming Madame Mao, a fictional biography, and the detective story Death of a Red Heroine. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Dusk, the new CD by pianist Andrew Hill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court issued a ruling today that limits the ability of states to give grandparents visitation rights to their grandchildren. The court ruled against a Washington state law, saying it went too far in saying that any person can win visitation rights to a child if the court says it's in the child's best interest. A lawyer for the parent in the case called it a victory for a parent's right to rear their children without state interference. A federal judge has ordered the White House to turn over emails that might concern three controversies: the FBI files, Linda Tripp, and Kathleen Willie. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth ordered the White House to turn over the emails within 20 days in response to a request in a civil suit filed by the conservative legal group Judicial Watch. Judicial Watch's Larry Klayman, who has filed other suits against the White House, is trying to prove that the White House used confidential material protected by the Privacy Act to attack its enemies, including Linda Tripp, the woman who secretly taped conversations with her then-friend, Monica Lewinsky, and Kathleen Willie, the woman who claims President Clinton made an unwanted sexual advance to her. The judge's order is unrelated to another request for emails from the White House by a congressional committee. Those emails, 100,000 or more of them, were not properly stored and are now being reconstructed from backup tapes to respond to requests from Congressman Dan Burton's Government Reform Committee and others. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
More than 50,000 people turned out to hear President Clinton speak today in Ukraine. Earlier today, the president spoke to Russia's lower house of parliament discussing the economy and disputes over arms control. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
President Clinton was given a polite but not an enthusiastic reception in the Duma a day after his summit talks failed to resolve a dispute over a national missile defense. Mr. Clinton tried to persuade lawmakers a U.S. missile shield would not hurt Russia's deterrence.
Despite our best efforts, the possibility exists that nuclear and other deadly weapons will fall into dangerous hands. In the hands that could threaten us both.
Some lawmakers came away unconvinced. Nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky, known for his outrageous behavior, shouted, "Stay out of our internal affairs," as Mr. Clinton left. Others, though, praised Mr. Clinton's balanced approach and said he sounded nostalgic, as if giving a farewell address to Russia. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 20 points to close at 10,815. Declining issues led advances by a small margin in light trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 8 points to close at 3,822. The S&P 500 declined 9 points to close at 1,467. This is NPR News. The Federal Election Commission says two major political parties have both nearly doubled the amount of unregulated soft money that they've raised over what they collected 4 years ago. Republicans have taken in more than $86 million and Democrats have gotten $77 million. Prosecutors have dropped murder charges against Baltimore Ravens linebacker Ray Lewis as part of a plea bargain. The NFL star and two friends were charged in the stabbing deaths of two Atlanta men at a post-Super Bowl party. Joshua Leves reports from member station WABE in Atlanta.
In court, over the last few weeks, prosecutors have been having trouble proving their case against Lewis and his friends Joseph Sweeting and Reginald Oakley. The three were on the scene of the brawl that led to the stabbings in January, but no one has testified to seeing someone stabbed, and some prosecution witnesses have changed their stories. Ray Lewis's attorney, Ed Garland, says there would have been an acquittal, but it wasn't what Lewis wanted.
There would be the lingering idea, well, the lawyers got him off. And that's not the case here. The DA came forward and said he is not guilty.
Under the agreement, Lewis pleaded to a misdemeanor charge of obstruction of justice for not giving police a complete statement, and he agreed to testify against his two co-defendants. He'll serve 1 year's probation. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Leves in Atlanta.
Aftershocks are still rattling Jakarta, Indonesia, after last night's earthquake that left at least 56 people dead and more than 500 injured. Rescue workers probed the rubble of collapsed buildings looking for survivors and bodies. They say the death toll could rise when communications are restored. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The current movie, The Virgin Suicides, is based on the novel of the same name. My guest is the author of the book, Jeffrey Eugenides. The New Yorker included him in its list of the 20 best American writers for the 21st century. We invited Eugenides to join us from the BBC studio in Berlin, where he's now living on a fellowship. Let's start with a reading from The Virgin Suicides, which was first published in 1993. The story is told in the collective voice of several men remembering back to their adolescence in the 70s, when they lived in a wealthy suburb of Detroit and became obsessed with five sisters in the neighborhood, the Lisbon Girls. Each of the Lisbon Girls committed suicide, and the reasons remain a mystery. In an attempt to understand the suicides, the novel becomes a reverie about the mysteries and unknowability of the world of teenaged girls.
On the morning the last Lisbon daughter took her turn at suicide, it was Mary this time, and sleeping pills, like Therese. The two paramedics arrived at the house knowing exactly where the knife drawer was, and the gas oven, and the beam in the basement from which it was possible to tie a rope. They got out of the EMS truck, as usual, moving much too slowly, in our opinion. And the fat one said under his breath, "This ain't TV, folks. This is how fast we go." He was carrying the heavy respirator and cardiac unit past the bushes that had grown monstrous and over the erupting lawn, tame and immaculate 13 months earlier, when the trouble began. Cecilia, the youngest, only 13, had gone first, slitting her wrists like a stoic while taking a bath. And when they found her afloat in her pink pool, with the yellow eyes of someone possessed and her small body giving off the odor of a mature woman, the paramedics had been so frightened by her tranquility that they had stood mesmerized. But then Mrs. Lisbon lunged in, screaming, and the reality of the room reasserted itself. Blood on the bath mat, Mr. Lisbon's razor sunk in the toilet bowl, marbling the water. The paramedics fetched Cecilia out of the warm water because it quickened the bleeding and put a tourniquet on her arm. Her wet hair hung down her back, and already her extremities were blue. She didn't say a word, but when they parted her hands, they found the laminated picture of the Virgin Mary she held against her budding chest.
That's Jeffrey Eugenides reading from his novel, The Virgin Suicides. Jeffrey, what was the germ of the idea of five sisters who all commit suicide?
It was a story told to me by my nephew's babysitter almost 10 years ago now. I was back in Detroit visiting my brother and got to talking to the babysitter that he and his wife had. And she was, I think, about 15 or 16. And I only met her for about 15 minutes, and within that span of time, she somehow told me that she and all her sisters had attempted suicide. And I was obviously shocked by that, and I asked her why, and she couldn't tell me why. She just said that she was under a lot of pressure. And then she disappeared, and she never worked for my brother again, and I was left with that that exchange and that mystery, and it lingered in my mind after that. But it was probably over a year or two before I began the novel, and I had the idea of a quintuple suicide in my mind, but I didn't know how to tell the story. And then at a certain point, I got the idea to tell the story with a collective narrator. And once I had the voice of the novel and the plot or the story, then I started writing it.
The collective narrator, that's the voice of the boys who fantasize about these five sisters and find them very kind of sexual and mysterious in the way that young teenage boys find young teenage girls. Their suicides, the girls' suicides, is a great mystery to these boys, and it's a mystery they never quite solved. Do you feel like you solved it?
No, I didn't. I mean, the book is really about the survivors of suicide more than the victims of suicide. And I've known a few people in my own life who've committed suicide and have been always left with a lot of questions in the same way. And that's my experience with suicide, so that's how I dealt with it in the book. I tried to give a lot of different possible reasons, including the narrative voice, showing why the girls might have done it. But I never thought that with anyone that I've known who's committed suicide, you could point to one exact reason.
Did you know a lot of people who committed suicide?
I knew two people who committed suicide, and the one that stuck in my mind most was a guy I went to college with who came over to my house the day before, and we got to talking about Zen for some reason, and he wanted to know what I knew about Zen. And you know, I sensed that he was very eager and a little bit manic to find out some solution to his problems in his life, but I never realized he was that depressed. And he actually borrowed a book from me on Zen and went home. And the next day, he killed himself.
What questions did that raise for you? Did you wonder, like, if your conversation put him over the edge or anything?
No, I mean, I could see that. I mean, that was the kind of experience that made me realize that you know, how limited is our understanding of other people's consciousness and the extent of their suffering, really, because he wasn't. Nothing we talked about was remotely connected to suicide.
To the boys who narrate The Virgin Suicides, the world of teenage girls is very exotic, very out of reach, and kind of forbidden. And there's a short passage that I think really sums up how exotic the teenage girls' world appears to the boys. And this is a sentence that has to do with, you know, they're telling the story of how one of the boys was over at the girl's house, one of the few boys ever to go over to the girl's house. And he needed the bathroom, and I think the downstairs bathroom was taken, so he had to go upstairs to the girls' bathroom,
right?
One of the sisters' bathroom. Would you read the sentence?
Sure. He came back to us with stories of bedrooms filled with crumpled panties, of stuffed animals hugged to death by the passion of the girls, of a crucifix draped with a brassiere, of gauzy chambers, of canopied beds, and of the effluvia of so many young girls becoming women together in the same cramped space.
Do you remember that era of your life, and did teenage girls seem really exotic and
yes,
very sexual and very forbidden?
I obviously remember it. People sometimes, having read the book, ask me, you must have had sisters, but actually the truth is that I only had brothers, and for that reason, a house with even one girl was always an exotic place for me. And when I was ever in a house with three or four, it was only multiplied. And I did feel that way. I mean, the bedrooms, the conduct of the parents, and the paraphernalia in a house with girls in it was so alien to me. And I would sort of pay attention and examine it as though I were on a sort of archaeological dig or something.
What did you find most exotic or arousing about the idea of a girl's bedroom or bathroom?
The amount of clothes and products, and usually the sort of slovenliness of the girls that I knew at that time, the amount of sweaters on the floor, the amount of nail polish and spilled drinks and everything that they would have. And I had a sort of neat little boy's bedroom at home, so it always seemed like very much full of life when I would go to other bedrooms of girls that I knew at the time.
The girls' diaries are eventually published, as I recall, and the boys read their diaries. And in one of the paragraphs they say, because of reading the diaries, we knew the pain of winter wind rushing up your skirt and the ache of keeping your knees together in class and how drab and infuriating it was to jump rope while the boys played baseball. We could never understand why the girls cared so much about being mature or why they felt compelled to compliment each other. But sometimes after one of us had read a long portion of the diary out loud, we had to fight back the urge to hug one another or tell each other how pretty we were. That's a really good and also really funny passage that, you know, is... It kind of gets at their attempts at empathy and what they could and couldn't relate to. Would you talk about writing that?
Well, I just tried to think of being, you know, I tried to remember when I was in sixth grade or something, and I would see the girls sort of cordoned off in a different world than we were in. We played a game called Kill the Man with the Ball on a gravel schoolyard lot, and we would just sort of maul each other, and then across the way, all the girls would be jumping rope. I just remembered that sort of partitioning in so many of the things in the early 60s, and I mean in the late 60s and early 70s when I was growing up. So I don't know what to say about, I didn't write it thinking to highlight any of the things that came out. I just tried to stay true to how I remembered feeling at the time.
Have you often found yourself wondering what girls find to be exotic about boys or appealing about boys as young teens?
I understood much later what girls liked about teenage boys. I was under the mistaken impression for a long time that what they liked was someone like them, someone perhaps more sensitive and talkative and someone who reads books and things like that. But I actually found that they, as boys, are sometimes attracted by the opposite. Girls seem to be also attracted by the opposite.
Which kind of boy were you?
I was the mistakenly sensitive one.
Who read books.
Yeah.
My guest is Jeffrey Eugenides, author of the novel The Virgin Suicides, which is the basis of the current film. Let's hear the scene we were just talking about. This scene has a couple of shifts in time and point of view. It begins with the boys reading from Cecilia's diary, which the plumber found after her first suicide attempt. Then the reading continues as we hear the voice of Cecilia reading an entry about her sister Lux. The scene ends with some reflections from the film's narrator, played by actor Giovanni Ribisi.
Today we went out on the boat. It was pretty cold. We saw a couple of whales. Lux leaned over and stroked the whale. I didn't think they would stink so much. It's the kelp in their baleens rotting. I hope we can go again sometime. And look, history's that. Lux lost it over Kevin...
Hines.
Is it Hines?
The garbage man.
The garbage man.
Lux lost it over Kevin Haynes, the garbage man. She'd wake up at 5 in the morning and hang out casually on the front steps, like it wasn't completely obvious. She wrote his name and marker on all her bras and underwear, and Mom found them and bleached out all the Kevins. Lux was crying on her bed all day.
And so we started to learn about their lives, coming to hold collective memories of times we hadn't experienced. We felt the imprisonment of being a girl, the way it made your mind active and dreamy, and how you ended up knowing what colors went together. We knew that the girls were really women in disguise, that they understood love and even death, and that our job was merely to create the noise that seemed to fascinate them. We knew that they knew everything about us and that we couldn't fathom them at all.
We'll talk more with the author of The Virgin Suicides after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Here comes that rainy day feeling again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Eugenides. He wrote the novel The Virgin Suicides that was recently adapted into a film. When the first girl attempts suicide in your novel and survives, she's taken to a psychiatrist, and he says, "What are you doing here, honey? You're not even old enough to know how bad life gets." And she answers, "Obviously, doctor, you've never been a 13-year-old girl." Now, Sofia Coppola, who made the film adaptation of your novel, said that that's the line that really made her want to do the movie, because she'd been a 13-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering your reaction to her reaction to that passage.
You know, the line is somewhat comic to me, and I was just glad that it struck a chord in her or in anyone else. Certainly, that's a line that has been repeated back to me quite often from women.
Now, you obviously have never been a 13-year-old girl yourself, but you're not writing from the perspective of a 13-year-old girl. You're writing from the perspective of the boys who are interested in these young girls. I think the movie adaptation tells the story a little bit from the perspective of the girls, too, because we're often alone with them in their rooms, mm-hmm. or alone with them in their scenes in the way that we're not in the novel, because it is always from the boys' point of
right.
view. And I'm wondering what you think of that shift, that slight shift of perspective in the movie. I assume that you've seen it.
I have seen it. I knew that the point of view in the movie would necessarily be more from the girls than the boys. I mean, it's very clear in the book that it's always anything they know about the girls is mediated through another source, and so therefore suspect. And the reader knows that what the boys are telling the reader might not be exactly the truth. When in a movie, when you have the girls in a scene and they're real live girls, and Kirsten Dunst is up on the screen, the audience can only believe this as actually the truth. Sophia was fairly scrupulous in tipping the audience off, you know, so that we know that the boys are watching all the time. But it's impossible to keep that in your mind, and the movie doesn't remind the audience or the reader as often as the book does. So that was something I knew would happen. I also felt that Sophia saw the book more from the girl's point of view. Because of her identification with the 13-year-old girl. And I've noticed in readers in general, the women will read the book and sort of see it from the girl's side, and boys will read it and see it from the boy's side.
There's a character and something he does that I want to ask you about. There's a character named Trip Fontaine, who's the handsome teen that all the girls have a crush on, and he takes one of the sisters to the homecoming. They have sex on the football field after the homecoming party. And when she falls asleep, he leaves. He walks out on her, and she has to take a cab home alone. He later says, "I liked her. I really liked her. I just got sick of her right then." Would you explain that for us? I think that's probably really getting to something that's really mysterious to girls and women about about boys.
Well, that is something I've heard similar things from friends, and not that many, but looking at his character, thinking about how Trip Fontaine had grown up, I felt that would be his reaction at that time. I don't think it's pandemic in men to act that way, actually. I just thought that in that situation with those characters, that's what would have happened.
Why? Because he's self-absorbed or no empathy? Maybe you just intuitively knew that that's how he would behave.
Well, a lot of the decisions in the book are just taken from things I'd witnessed. So I sort of don't have to always know the reason
uh-huh.
why someone acted that way. I just remember that in such a situation, this person did react that way. And it's more a reporting. I mean, this book is not a psychological book in terms of going into the different people's heads. So I'm not sure that I can answer that. I think you would come up with the kind of trivialities about not being able to connect or the problem with his mother leaving him that I actually wouldn't want to indulge in.
You grew up in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. I believe that's a very affluent.
It is.
Suburb of Detroit.
I was born in Detroit, and then we moved to Grosse Pointe.
And the novel is set in a similar suburban setting.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that you remember about growing up in a suburb that you wanted to put into the novel?
The biggest thing, I think, about where I grew up and how it affected the book was that in Detroit, obviously going through the riots in 1967, I saw the city sort of be destroyed, and my experience of growing up was with things coming apart and falling apart, and it imbued my childhood with a sense of elegy and a sense of entropy that I think is really the basic spirit of the Virgin Suicides. When I really think, why did I write this book, I think it comes from growing up in a city and at a time, even in America, where things seem to be getting worse and falling apart, and society and the economy. And, you know, in my life, anytime we would get in the car and drive, we would see burned out houses and burned out streets. The bar that my grandfather owned was burned down, and that it was like not exactly growing up in Beirut, but it had that kind of feeling. And I think those atmospherics are really central to the book, and actually central to my inspiration for writing it.
Since your was it your grandfather's bar, did you say, that was burned down?
My grandfather's bar, yeah.
Did that mean that you took the riots kind of personally, as like a personal condemnation?
No. It wasn't burned. His bar was burned down later. It wasn't burned down during the riots. But the neighborhood was sort of hurt by the riots and got worse and worse. And finally, like many things in Detroit, his bar was burned.
What was it like to live surrounded by prosperity after that?
It's a very strange way to grow up. It's almost an experience like a South African upbringing or something like that. Incredible racial divide. I've never experienced a racial divide like Detroit's. The enmity and the misunderstanding in a place like that affects you very strongly. I went to a prep school, so it was actually the only school where there were black students, and otherwise in Grosse Pointe, in the public schools, there weren't any black students at all.
Jeffrey Eugenides is the author of The Virgin Suicides, which is the basis of the new film. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jeffrey Eugenides, author of The Virgin Suicides. Maureen Corrigan reviews two novels about China, one a fictional biography of Madame Mao, the other a detective story. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by pianist Andrew Hill. We're listening to it now.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Eugenides. His 1993 novel, The Virgin Suicides, has been adapted into a film by Sofia Coppola. Eugenides has also written short stories and book reviews. In a review that you wrote of Tom Wolfe's novel, A Man in Full, you described yourself as a guy who spends all day in his room. But when you were young, you must have traveled a lot, because I know you traveled through Egypt, you worked with Mother Teresa.
Yeah, I traveled. I took a year off in college and traveled around the world for 9 months on $3,500. And it was a great experience. And yeah, I lived four months in India and did work for a short time with Mother Teresa. And went as far as Thailand and went all through Europe and went to North Africa.
How did you get involved with Mother Teresa? And what kind of work did you do with her?
I worked at the Home for the Destitute and Dying, which is sort of her flagship operation, where people are brought in close to death and usually do die, sometimes recover. And a lot of people work there in the morning, European and American and Australian volunteers can come in for 3 or 4 hours and work, and the rest of the time the sisters run the place. And I didn't work there that long, and I have something half written about it, about that experience, but I found that I was not exactly capable of becoming a missionary. It was sort of a turning point in my life where I realized my vocation for writing and not my vocation for that sort of commitment.
What made you realize that?
Well, some sort of lowly parts of my character, which I've had to embrace, but the fact that I actually couldn't get along or didn't enjoy being with the other people who worked at Mother Teresa's, I found them, as you might imagine, sometimes really lacking in any sense of humor. They were sometimes were very good, but sort of good in a dull way, and I just felt. I don't mean to condemn them, but I just felt so different than them. I felt that anything that was, was admirable about me just wasn't the same kind of thing that was admirable about them. And I just saw that it wasn't really my place to be. And at the same time, I was staying at the Salvation Army in Calcutta, and hanging out with sort of some crazy Germans who had been traveling for 17 years, and I found them so interesting, and their openness of mind just appealed to me so much more that it just seemed to come down in my life as a choosing between two paths or something, and I chose the other one.
Did you meet Mother Teresa, and did you think of her as a saint?
I met her briefly and saw her occasionally, and because she's called a saint, I guess when you're so prepared to think of her as a saint, I don't. My religious background wasn't sufficient that I actually believed in actual sainthood or in magical properties in a person, but obviously I knew that's Mother Teresa, and watched her every move. The strange thing is that when I saw her, who she reminded me of was George Burns, the comedian. Because she was just sort of hunched over and had a slightly humorous sort of aura about her. Not that she was being funny, but there was just something that made you sort of smile. And, I mean, if you just put the cigar in her hand, it would have been complete.
She was really an old vaudevillian, wasn't she?
I thought so. I thought perhaps she'd missed her. She'd taken the wrong path.
Was it at all a spiritual experience, and did you try to impose a spirituality on it if it didn't feel spiritual, feeling like it was supposed to feel spiritual?
I tried to impose a spirituality on it. The short story I'm writing about it will hopefully explain all this better than I can in speech, but I was in a way, I was 20. I mean, if you ever read William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, there's a long passage about people in late adolescence, which is what I still felt I was at around 20, and that they have enough ego to make sort of very strict decisions about themselves, and yet their ego is still unformed and sort of cloud-like, and they feel affinity for sort of mystical states. And I think that describes me pretty well. I was sort of putting on another persona and trying to live a life to see whether I could do it. And I was very mystically minded in that time. And I wouldn't take it back. It was one of the greatest periods of my life, and I think perhaps the happiest. But in some ways, it was a little bit of a theater piece, sort of acting the missionary and trying to see if I could change my life completely. And I had certain models in my mind, like Thomas Merton or people like that, sort of literary religious saints or converts, people who had really changed their lives radically. And I wanted that sort of thing. I think in many ways I wanted to escape my body or my physical existence because of all of the sort of difficulties one has with passion and with dating and with all of that sort of thing when you're 20. And I think part of that sort of inspired me to sort of move up from my lower chakras into my upper chakra and sort of turn to vapor and come out my head. You know, that's right. Sort of what I wanted.
Right.
And I got over it.
Right. Can't deal with it, transcend it.
Right.
I'm wondering how your parents felt about this, and I'm going to go back to the virgin suicides and quote a line here. When a daughter is found dead after she commits suicide with a picture of the Virgin Mary in her hands, her father later says, "We baptized her, we confirmed her, and now she believes this crap." Do you think your parents might have had a slightly similar reaction when you were out working with Mother Teresa?
My parents at the time were not very religious. My father was never religious, and I didn't have a very religious upbringing. My family was, extremely alarmed at my behavior during the what is known as the Mother Teresa years. In playing out this role and trying to see how it fit, I certainly wrote letters home that were ecstatic and troubling to my mother and to my brothers, and. You know, to me, it was just more fiction writing. What I was really doing was writing fiction, but they didn't understand that. They just saw that it was a letter home. I was out of contact with them, and they didn't know what was happening to me. And I have written a short story, actually, that deals with that experience called Airmail, which is about a young guy in Thailand who is very sick with amoebic dysentery, who's writing letters home and letters to everyone that he knows about his spiritual adventure that he's going on. And he's half enlightened and half cracked. And I, again, took my own life and exaggerated it beyond what I went through. I was actually not quite around the bend. My parents were. The strange thing is after that, my brother became a born-again Christian and my mother became religious. And now they're sort of the fanatics in the family. I'm sort of the secular one again.
My guest is Jeffrey Eugenides, author of the novel The Virgin Suicides. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Eugenides is my guest. He's the author of the novel The Virgin Suicides that was recently adapted into a movie. Granta, the literary magazine, last year named you one of the best young American novelists. The New Yorker, at the end of 1999, put you on a list of the best writers of the 21st century, a snapshot of a generation on the eve of the next century. And I believe you're about to turn 40.
I am 40 now.
You are 40.
Yeah.
So you're officially not a young writer anymore.
Yeah, I'm officially no longer qualified to be in those lists.
Exactly, exactly. Did that feel like you were crossing a threshold, or just a kind of unimportant imaginary threshold?
That affected my life more than having the book made into a movie. Turning 40, you suddenly realize that you're no longer a young writer. I was happy to see that George Eliot wrote Middlemarch at 50, though. So you're always sort of looking ahead to the older people to give yourself, make yourself feel a little bit better about the future.
What's the difference in feeling like you're officially a young writer, and then feeling you're no longer officially a young writer?
Well, from my friends who have jumped the great divide already, they actually tell me that it's sort of a relief because you don't have to worry about these kinds of groupings. I think once you're 40, you feel like you must know what you're doing, whereas maybe in your 20s and 30s, you're a little happier to be at sea. Writing books is always, makes one feel always that you're a little bit at sea. So it's probably a little bit more difficult in your 40s to carry on and not feel that you don't have all the answers. But on the other hand, it's having a child and turning 40 is a sort of it's a great disciplining force in my life, and I find that for the first time in my life I get up extremely early and start working instead of dawdling over my coffee and things like that. So I actually have found it beneficial to become old.
Or older, anyway.
Yeah.
I think there's a special attitude toward young writers now. Like, thank God there are some, because the belief is that few young people are interested in reading, let alone writing. Did you feel that there was this special sense of gratitude to young writers?
I don't think so. I was just reading the article about Philip Roth in The New Yorker, where he's saying every year 70 writers die and only two are replaced. And he says, you can look at it. It's the continuation of the screen, from the movie screen to the television screen to the computer screen. But I grew up with the television screen and now the computer screen, and nothing, I don't find anything in my life as rewarding as reading. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as he is about young people reading. And I get a lot of mail from young readers. And I don't sense that strongly, and I don't think anyone at the New Yorker or Grant have felt that either, that I could tell.
You're living in Germany now. What brought you there?
I'm here on a fellowship from the German. It's sort of the German foreign exchange program, and they have a smaller program within that called the Berliner Künstlerprogramm, and that brings artists and writers and composers from all over the world to live in Berlin. It's sort of a vestige from the time that the wall was up, to show free expression and artistic creativity inside West Berlin, but it's survived, fortunately, the walls coming down.
What's it like for you to be in a country where your first language isn't always understood and you're a writer functioning with diminished language abilities?
It hasn't affected my writing at all, because I'm spend most of my time as is true as I said in the article, in my room. So most of the day is spent with English in my head, and then when I go out to speak German or attempt my German at night, it's fine. I actually have enjoyed learning another language, and people ask me, is it messing with your writing? But it hasn't at all. My German's not good enough to get into my brain that deeply at this point. I don't know if there comes a point where you start dreaming it and then you can't use English syntax, but I don't think that would happen.
Has living in Germany been affecting what you read, what you choose to read?
Mm-hmm. Not too much so far, except that I know a lot about, I read the German papers, so I know a lot more about German politics and strikes and things like that than I ever did.
So when did you come back to the States?
That's open-ended. We like it here, and we have no other house, my wife and I, Karen. And Berlin is actually a pretty good city if you have a small child, which we do. So we're staying another year, and we'll see how long we stay.
Well, good
luck
there.
It's more affordable than New York, so.
Uh-huh. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Eugenides is the author of The Virgin Suicides, which has been adapted into a film. He spoke to us from the BBC studio in Berlin. Last summer, book critic Maureen Corrigan spent a few weeks in China. This summer, she's paying off credit card bills and relying on the consolations of fiction until she can make a return trip.
China is inscrutable, a land of mists and shadows, double talk, and official cover stories that change with the wind. And lest you think me an ignorant Westerner for saying that, I'm just paraphrasing the view of two wonderful new novels about China, both written in English by Chinese who emigrated as adults to the United States. Both these writers have also paid a high personal price for the political cynicism that informs their novels. An Chi Min was celebrated for her 1994 memoir, Red Azalea, which recounted her childhood in Shanghai, her hardships on a communist labor farm, and the strange twist of fortune that transformed her into a leading actress in the propaganda films churned out by Madame Mao Zedong's minions. After Madame Mao was denounced for murdering her husband, one crime she didn't commit, Min, who was regarded as one of her protégés, was banished once again to the labor farm. She managed to come to the United States in 1984 with the help of another actress, Joan Chen. Min has written a poetic fictional biography called Becoming Madame Mao that fleshes out the picture of the woman known as the white-boned demon. In Min's recreation, it's a life story so lurid, so packed with ambition, it should have already been made into a Madonna bio flick, a Chinese compliment to Evita. Born in rural China to a concubine, the future Madame Mao rebelled as a child against her mother's attempts to bind her feet. That mutinous spirit drove her to Shanghai, where she became a B-movie actress and opera singer and a three-time loser in marriage. According to this novel, she joined the Communist Party more out of career aspirations than political convictions, and in 1934 met and ensnared Mao Zedong. The rest, as they say, is history, culminating in Madame Mao's own fall from power and her imprisonment and suicide. Madame Mao is a hard woman to keep company with, even for the space of this engaging 300-page novel. But to Min's great credit as a writer, she humanizes without sentimentalizing Madame Mao. To vary our view, Min alternates a retrospective voice of history commentary with first-person narration, which gives us, at least imaginatively, a glimpse into Madame Mao's mind. A proto-feminist, a monster, a relentless self-promoter who always saw herself as a peacock among hens, a fool for love, a second-rate sensitive mind, Madame Mao is made into all those things in this novel, whose literary elegance is provocatively at odds with its blood-drenched subject. Madame Mao spent years trying to make it in showbiz in Shanghai, the fascinating city that's the setting for Xu Shoulong's stupendous first novel, a detective story called Death of a Red Heroine. Xu was born there, became a poet and translator of the works of W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot, studied in the United States, and after Tiananmen, decided it was too dangerous to return to China. Xu's detective, Chief Inspector Shen Cao of the Shanghai Police Bureau, is also a poet in his spare time, a lover of the bourgeois verses of T.S. Eliot, and what's more risky in contemporary China, a believer in poetic justice. When the corpse of a strangled woman turns out to be that of a celebrated model worker, whose personal life, Cao discovers, was far from exemplary, Cao bucks communist cadre opposition to crack the case, or so he thinks. What's so brilliant about this novel, besides its hard-boiled intricate plot and subtly developed characters, is its vivid picture of China in the 1990s, on the verge of an historic shift into capitalism. Entrepreneurs, Cao observes, were springing up like bamboo shoots after a spring rain. On an investigative trip into the countryside, Cao sees a peasant girl selling bowls of tea by the road, and he muses on the poetic possibilities of the scene. But when the girl also turns out to be selling black market computer disks, his reverie is broken. Cao himself is a tortured fellow, a guy who's enjoyed some political perks and who now realizes the tragic impossibility of being a dedicated Communist Party member and a dedicated police detective. Two novels about China, both standouts. Which one do I recommend to readers short of time who want to deepen their knowledge of the country? No contest. Death of a Red Heroine may only be a humble detective novel in contrast to the literary fiction of Becoming Madame Mao, but it does what detective fiction can do best. It captures the details, the grit of everyday life. As Chief Inspector Cao learns, sometimes you can't think in categories. Sometimes even the lowly oyster of genre fiction produces a matchless pearl.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed two new novels about China, Becoming Madame Mao and Death of a Red Heroine. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by Andrew Hill. This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Andrew Hill is an elusive figure on several levels. For a long time, folks weren't even sure where he came from. Early on, he claimed to have been born in Haiti, although he's really from Chicago. He's always resisted categorizing as either mainstream or avant-garde, since his music is both lyrical and unpredictable. Periodically, Hill will earn acclaim for some good records and then all but vanish from the spotlight. His first new record in almost 10 years is out now. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it was worth the wait.
Typical Andrew Hill. The unpredictable halts and surges in his timing and an ending you don't see coming. Such quirks can make it hard for other players to join in. Hill's made some records where his side folk had to keep guessing where his next beat would fall and sometimes guessed wrong. But in the 90s, a number of younger players arrived who could follow his unsignaled turns, maybe because they came up listening to Andrew Hill records. The five musicians who join him on his new CD are about a generation younger. With Marty Ehrlich and Greg Tardy on saxophones. On trumpet is up-and-comer Ron Horton, who put out a nice CD of his own recently called Genius Envy. Andrew Hill's new CD on the Palmetto label is called Dusk. As much as Hill plays with timing and meter on his new record, that last piece is in 7/8 time, for example, he crams the CD with a lot of quietly catchy melodies. Thank you. That's Scott Colley on bass. Andrew Hill looks for ways to sidestep the usual jazz format of a theme followed by a string of solos followed by the theme again. Hill might call for a solo before the theme has been sounded, or play the theme between solos, or even in the middle of a solo, or change tempo when a theme repeats, or write multiple sections for one piece. A lot can happen in the space of a minute, as on Ball Square. It's a sort of concerto for Billy Drummond, a perfect drummer for Hill. He can bring the rhythm to a full boil and keep his solo statements clear and focused. Three horns and three rhythm instrumentation of Andrew Hill's sextet deliberately evokes his classic 1964 album, Point of Departure, but he doesn't revisit its sound. His new disc has its own flavor, sweet enough to make converts of the uninitiated. Andrew Hill is now in his early 60s, and the title Dusk may suggest he's winding down, but his music says otherwise. This season, Hill's also on saxophonist Greg Osby's CD, The Invisible Hand, where the pianist's oddball timing is even more dramatically displayed. It is a good moment for Andrew Hill fans. His new CD feels less like dusk than the so-called magic hour just before it, when indirect light bathes everything in a warm glow.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed Dusk by Andrew Hill. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today we welcome our new associate producer, Megan Howell. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publisher of Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris, available in bookstores nationwide. And from Random House Inc.'s Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Protecting the Gift, A Parent's Guide to Keeping Children and Teenagers Safe by Gavin DeBecker. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, British novelist Martin Amis discusses his new memoir, which is in part about his father, the late writer Kingsley Amis. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.